each year on October 25th at Wyoming Catholic College, it's a tradition for someone to stand up on a cafeteria table at lunchtime and ask in a loud voice, "What's he that wishes so? My cousin Westmoreland?" Welcome to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast on the great books and the liberal arts. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. October 25th is St. Crispin's Day, and those two questions begin the St. Crispin's Day speech given by King Henry in Act 4, Scene 3 of Shakespeare's play, Henry V. Henry of England, having invaded France, is faced with a decisive battle in which he is badly outnumbered. In discussing the situation, the Duke of Westmoreland wishes for more troops. Henry's response, though, takes him by surprise. "I just assumed there were fewer." I'll read the speech in its entirety before Dr. Glenn Arbery, president of Wyoming Catholic College, tells us more about Henry's story. "What's he that wishes so? My cousin Westmoreland? No, my fair cousin. If we are marked to die, we are enow to do our country loss. And if to live, the fewer men, the greater share of honor. God's will, I pray thee, wish not one man more. By Jove, I am not covetous for gold, nor care I who doth feed upon my cost. It yearns me not if men my garments wear. Such outward things dwell not in my desires. But if it be a sin to covet honor, I am the most offending soul alive. No faith, my cuz, wish not a man from England God's peace. I would not lose so great an honor as one man more, methinks, would share from me for the best hope I have. Oh, do not wish one more. Rather proclaim it, Westmoreland, through my host, that he which hath no stomach to this fight, let him depart. His passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put in his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us. This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when the day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly on the vigil feast his neighbors and say, 'Tomorrow is St. Crispian.' Then he will strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, 'These wounds I had on Crispin's day.' Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Essex, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the end of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap whilst any speak that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day." Dr. Arbery, Henry V is part of Shakespeare's second tetralogy of plays. What does that mean? How does this play fit in?
This is the fourth play in the second group of history plays that Shakespeare wrote about the English kings. The first tetralogy actually follows this one chronologically, but it's the first one that Shakespeare wrote. And that consists of first three parts of Henry VI, and then the fourth one of that tetralogy is Richard III, which is a pretty famous play in its own right, usually not read as the end of the tetralogy about Henry VI and the Wars of the Roses. The second tetralogy begins with the kingship of Richard II, who was an anointed king, undoubtedly legitimate in terms of what the English expected of kings, but also a very bad king and a very weak one in terms of his own dissolute nature. So Shakespeare wrote four plays about the movement from the kingship of Richard II through that of Henry IV, who was in the line of kingship, but, you know, in terms of, if you bring a stickler, obviously a usurper, since he displaced Richard from the throne, and then into the kingship of Henry V, who has to, in a sense, make his own legitimacy.
Henry V as a prince was rather different from Henry as the king. For example, as a prince, he's drinking buddies with Falstaff. As the king, he says to Falstaff, "I banish thee on pain of death not to come near our person by 10 miles. What brings about the change? What's going on with Henry?
This is a really interesting part of this tetralogy, because everybody thinks of Prince Hal, as he's known familiarly, as this kind of wastrel. His father's ashamed of him because he hangs around the bars. He's even been accused of being part of robberies that Falstaff and others arrange. But Prince Hal, early in Henry IV, Part One, announces his intention, which is to use the sort of bar scene and the expectations that people get of him after having seen him in these settings, to use those in order to make his reformation even more spectacular. From the very outset, he has this in mind. He says things like, "My reformation, glittering or my fault, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off." So, you know, it's as though he's already thinking of all these very funny and kind of heartwarming guys around him, who are nevertheless drunkards and thieves. He's already thinking of them as the dark backdrop against which his sudden emergence from this life of sin is going to show him up like the prodigal son. It's a little cold, you know, to think about what he's doing, because he's really using these men in order to reject them when the time comes for him to be king.
Now, his father is a usurper. Does that make him a usurper? And if so, how does he seek to legitimize his claim?
Yeah, how does the son of a usurper claim legitimacy? That's the question. And it's the question that he seems to have in mind from the very outset. He knows that his father's regime as king, his time as king, is pretty much doomed. That is, the people who helped him get into the kingship are going to expect more than they ever get. There are other claimants to the throne, such as the one that comes through previous son, older than Henry IV's father, John of Gaunt, you know, and so on. They're just, you know, it's just a real nest of complications in all this. But Prince Hal sees that he's going to have to do something to distinguish himself from his father and to gain, at least in the popular mind, a legitimacy that he doesn't have in terms of this kind of sacramental kingship that Richard II talks about. He says, you know, not all the water in the rough, rude sea can wash the balm from off an anointed king. So he really thinks of it as almost like priesthood. It's something that can't be washed away, regardless of personal sins or anything like that. So Henry has to come up with some, this is Henry V, has to come up with some new way to bring about the effect of having been chosen by God.
And how does he do that?
Well, he does it in part by his ruse of reformation. That is, you know, being ready when the time comes just to cast aside all of the companions of his youth and seem that he's suddenly taken on all these virtues, as though the graces of office had descended on him just at that moment. The way I put it when, you know, I was thinking about it during the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought was that it's only the legitimate king who would have those graces descend upon him. So putting on the crown is, in a sense, like in the Arthurian legends, you know, the sword and the stone. It's only fitting, right, for the one who is meant to have it. So that's a kind of ruse of legitimacy. But then later, when he takes the army of the English and he, you know, he unites the nation in this foreign war against France, he puts everybody in real circumstances of risk that, you know, whose outcome he cannot predict. And the Battle of Agincourt, when he is surrounded by the French, his men are tired, they're worn out after a long siege, they're just trying to get back to the coast and get back to England. But the French surround them, they have five times as many troops as the English, and so it's a crisis in his kingship and in the, you know, the life of the English nation at that point. And so that's the risk that he can't manipulate, you know, to his own advantage.
Now that's the context for the St. Crispin's Day speech. Tell
exactly.
us about that.
After a hard night of wandering through the English soldiers, Henry comes back to see all the nobles who are gathered around him. They all know that the odds are massively against them. And I believe it's Westmoreland says, you know, would that we had, you know, 1/10,000th of the men, you know, still sleeping in England or something to that effect. And Henry says, don't wish a single man more, you know, and then he goes on into this, you know, absolutely stunning speech about how they turn the odds against them into the greater occasion for their own honor when they win. And it's one of those speeches that is famous for being stirring. And it's just interesting to think how it works, you know, how he turns an occasion of near despair into one where they're all old men in the bars, you know, looking back and showing their scars and talking about how they got them on St. Crispin's Day. So, yeah, beautiful speech and entirely effective in turning the morale of the men in a different direction.
Well, and of course, they win the Battle of Agincourt.
I don't think we'd remember the St. Crispin's Day speech
if they didn't. Exactly. But then Henry, all the bravado goes out of Henry in terms of all the things he says is in the St. Crispin's Day speech just evaporate. And he says, we're not going to talk about this anymore.
Right. He tells all the men before the battle that the honor that they have, he'll share. He is king, the aristocrats. It doesn't matter what their birth is. Whoever fights in this battle will share in that honor, you know, and be ennobled by their participation in it. So it's almost a renunciation of kingly privilege, aristocratic privilege. There's a sort of democratizing and uplifting sense that everyone who is able to participate has the same level of worth. And that galvanizes the men. And in the aftermath, as you say, when they see the absolute disparity between the losses on the French side and the losses on the English side, you know, 10,000 or more on the French side, and when they're going over the list on the English side, it's something like 25. And so Henry sees this and says, this isn't us, this is God's hand. And so he forbids anyone to boast about the battle. I mean, they ascribe the victory to God alone and go off singing the Te Deum and so on. But this is the sign, in effect, that Henry has needed to legitimate his own kingship. He needed a sort of miracle. It's a sort of David versus Goliath moment. You know, it has a biblical feel. And it's one that Henry claims not for himself, but for God. But even in doing that, he's establishing a greater legitimacy for his own kingship.
And how in this does Shakespeare talk to us about courage? What does he teach us?
Well, I think he teaches us that there's a way that the appeal to honor, to those higher characteristics of spiritedness, drive away the lower thoughts of fear and despair that seem to beset the men. When Henry gives that speech, he simply arouses in all those who hear it, even those who read it now, right? If you hear it now. We had a wonderful reading of it at the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought by a man named Brian Kennedy, who just got every nuance, I thought, as he was going through it. It's a speech that appeals to that part of your nature that the Greeks call thumos, you know, this spirited part, the heart, you know, courage, things like that. And that's really the occasion in the play, and really in all of Shakespeare, where you see that appeal most explicitly.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. So many familiar phrases in our English language come directly from Shakespeare. Perhaps it's time, in the words of Cole Porter, to brush up your Shakespeare. He makes wonderful summer reading and treats the whole of human life, from cowardice to courage, hatred to love, anger to forgiveness, madness to wisdom. And some of his plays are just downright hilarious. And if your vacation includes air travel, you'll also probably get into an interesting conversation with your seatmates about the value of the liberal arts. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.